Good afternoon to all of our listeners. You are tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your host from the next hour. Here are some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Surah Yasin is considered the heart of the Quran for its tremendous benefits for the believer. The best drink according to Quran is milk. In the Quran, Allah also describes the rivers of milk in heaven. The best food according to Quran is honey, which cures several problems and is the sweetest gift to humans from Allah. Normally, the Quran declares Friday as the most blessed day of the week, and the month of Ramadan is the best month of the year. And the night of Qadr has been described as a night better than 1,000 months. Its significance is described in chapter Al-Qadr. And now we'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. We start off with the Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have Back to Reality. Guests on this program have experienced living in a non-Muslim country. The main theme of the program is Muslims living in non-Islamic country. And to round up this hour's programs, we have Iran Today. The program presents the latest advances in science and technology in the Islamic Republic of Iran. It also highlights the latest business and economic developments in Iran. Stay with us for the next hour.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome everyone to this episode of Spotlight. On the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, the streets of the global capitals are filled not just with solidarity, but with a fierce indictment. People worldwide are rising to condemn their own government's complicity in the brutal reality, while diplomats and the architects of Trump's so-called peace plan proclaim progress. The facts on the ground tell a different story. A story of a relentless genocide in Gaza, a story of illegal expansion and summary executions in the occupied West Bank, a story of a people being systematically erased, all under the watchful eyes of an international community that claims all is going well. Tonight, we cut through the false narrative. We stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people by speaking the truth to power and demanding to know how long will this atrocity be allowed to continue. To analyze and discuss this reality, we are joined by Mr. Mick Manapierre, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign from Glasgow. And Mr. Ali Hamiyeh, political analyst and military expert, joining us from South Lebanon. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you both for joining us in this episode of Spotlight, a very important day. And November the 29th has yet again come upon us. The solidarity of Palestine, however, the genocide continues. The occupation continues. Mr. Napier, I would like to go ahead and start off with you with these global protests. Let's go ahead and start off. What does the term solidarity actually truly mean when governments of the West continue to arm and fund this Israeli war machine?
Well, solidarity means what it meant for me as a young man with the Vietnam Solidarity Movement worldwide, which was successful in defeating American militarism. And solidarity meant that people in the imperial countries, many of them understood that the state that was carrying out a genocide in Vietnam or Palestine is also the enemy of many people in that country. That we don't stand on the sidelines and applaud. We see ourselves as an extension to the Palestinian struggle for freedom. And we see our fate and our future tied to that struggle. Because a state that can be actively involved in the prosecution of a genocide that can commit which can actively support the crimes that we have seen over many decades, but very dramatically over the last 2 years. That state is the enemy of most of its citizens as well, because this state has actively promoted the genocide. The British Air Force has flown over Gaza more than 500 times, supplying intelligence to the killers on the ground, and the minister responsible boasting about it. So the genocide is abundantly clear, and unlike genocides before, is really undeniable. But the complicity of our government, which in past genocides has been concealed, has been hidden, is very, very clear. So, for example, many of your readers might not even know that the British government and the Americans supported the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, that genocidal government. But virtually nobody knows about that today. But millions and millions, maybe billions of people know that Britain and America and the EU have been complicit in this particular genocide. So to answer your question very quickly, solidarity is understanding that the enemy of the people of Gaza is our enemy as well, and that we have no choice but to try to join in that fight in every way that we can, because if they succeed, it becomes a dark world for everybody.
Well, exactly. Mr. Napier, you mentioned something very important, and I'm going to bring that over to Mr. Ali Hamia. Thank you very much for your patience, Doctor. When it comes to what Mr. Napier mentioned about there's even genocides that have been erased, no one even virtually knows about them because how good they've been covered by the U.S. and their allies. In this case, how effective can these international solidarity movements that we have specifically seen today, as they've been proclaimed as the biggest seen yet, be when these political establishments in the U.S., in Europe, and of course their own allies remain so deeply entrenched in specifically now that we're speaking about Gaza, their support for the Zionist regime?
Well, let's say that the Western Hemisphere, and especially United States, and exactly the Israeli entity, are very good in playing the role of the victim at all time while they are the executioner. And also they are very good playing at the media whenever they want to put something on the surface or underground. Let's see example, Sudan, it's still the same going on Sudan for years. And now they just take it out of the sleeve and they put it on the table and everybody is talking about Sudan. So they are very good at when they want to talk about a genocide or talking about nothing is happening or just bury it underground. Let's see what's going on now. We see the people are with the solidarity standing with the Palestinian people. The governments are acting complicity with the Israeli entity. The people are acting also to save the humanity. I'm talking in general. But the governments are killing the humanity. And especially when we are talking about Gaza. Gaza is the most certified genocide massacre committed by the Israeli entity for now. Since the Holocaust, what they so called, nothing is in our hand, but we believed it because we stand by people that been killed and burned in Germany, and we have no evidence, solid evidence of the numbers that been killed. Now we are talking about Gaza in front of all global media and in front of all the people in the world being killed and being genocide and ethnic cleansing. And we can see that people are in one place, the governments are in other places. So who will be more effective at the end? I think the media will play the biggest role to just put the spotlight on what's going on in Gaza, what's going on around the world, what's the government of United States and the Israelis, and also some from time to time you can see big role of United Kingdom and Germany around the world. But who can continue, who can consider and win the war of media? I think this is the best way now to put on the surface the war on media and the war for the humanity in Gaza. In this case, we have to be with the solidarity of the people standing with the Palestinian now.
Well, exactly, Mr. Hamia, and as we mentioned at the beginning in our intro, that we are laying out the complete truth, this false narrative. With that, you brought up something very important, that who's going to be stopping this as we see it's continuing. And let's go ahead and remind our viewers that with Mr. Napier, just over a month ago in Egypt, I mean, we saw these leaders, top leaders of these nations around the world gather with Trump, sign the so-called peace plan. And at that specific moment, many people had a sparkle of hope that, okay, maybe this can actually make a difference. Since then, these executors of Trump's so-called peace plan insist this is still working. I mean, do they not open their phones? Do they not see the media? Do they not see the images, as Mr. Hamia had mentioned? Do they not watch the same horrific scenes? Listen to these heartbreaking stories as we do. We have the acceleration of settlements in the occupied West Bank, where people are literally being kicked out of their homes, being beaten. And if they refuse, their homes that they've had for generations, they are killed. And of course, let's not forget about this continuation of genocide in Gaza. Sewage is flooding the tents. What exactly is this term working mean for these people?
I think it means that Israel is succeeding in killing a large number of Palestinians. Still, that's what it means. We're witnessing something akin to what we thought, or many people thought, was consigned to the history books with the great anti-colonial struggles of the 60s and 70s, where many countries in Africa and Asia and Latin America became independent. And it was thought that that was the end of colonialism, because colonialism meant that Britain or France or Germany or America could go anywhere in the world where they had superior means of violence and take what they wanted. They could pillage, rob, exploit, kill, and even exterminate in many cases. Very few of your readers will know that Winston Churchill was responsible for killing 3 million people in Bengal in 1943-44, when there was plenty of food, but they arranged a famine. So that was the crimes of colonialism, and brown-skinned people were inferior and did not have the same rights as white people or their allies. In those days, Britain could invade countries because, quote unquote, we were Christians and they were not. That gave the European countries the right to exterminate and kill. That they don't talk like that anymore, except for Trump. But now it's, we have democracy, whatever that is, and they don't, whatever that is. And therefore, we have the right to bomb and kill and invade. I mean, it's not in the Middle East, but we're watching the news headlines today as Trump begins to invade Venezuela, just like a 19th and early 20th century colonial power. No excuse, no reason other than the thinnest one. And he's using aircraft carriers and will use bombers to defeat that government. It is open banditry. We are watching the wheel of progress run in reverse. And Gaza is simply the most extreme example of that. That ability, that readiness to exterminate people who sit on land that somebody wants. Somebody wants Venezuela's oil. Somebody wants the land surface of Palestine. Those who stand in their way have no rights. And the people who gathered in Cairo were simply Mr. Sykes and Monsieur Picot from the early 20th century, who divided up the Middle East, who drew the borders without any reference to the local people. Balfour said, we don't take into account the opinions of the local people. They're not important. So this racism is so rampant and so extreme that the people of Gaza had no right to determine their own future. That was to be done by America and its allies and servants and clones. So it's a very grim situation, but we see rising anger. Thousands of people have been arrested and charged in Britain with terrorism. I myself have been charged with terrorism and face 14 years in prison for opposing the genocide. In Italy recently, we saw the dockers refuse to move Israeli materials and riots and street fighting in support of the Palestinian people against the Meloni pro-Israel regime. So we see a rising anger. It's certainly rising. And there's nothing strange about that. The barbarity of Israel, although it's far too slow, nonetheless, it's eating away at stability in the Western countries.
Well, exactly, Mr. Napier, if you don't mind me cutting you off, I do want to fit in some more questions as our time is running out. Mr. Hami and Mr. Napier spoke about what the Zionist regime has committed, what the U.S. has backed it with, its impunity, and, of course, the continued silence of the international community. And he did speak about this agreement in Cairo. With the situation, we've seen, of course, that we're still in phase one, and we still see the Hamas fighters under fire, gunfire, still trying to search for the remains of the Zionist captives. And again, the phase one had, just to remind our audience and viewers, they were supposed to return the remains of the captives within 72 hours, which Hamas at the moment mentioned. This is definitely something nearly impossible because of the continued mass of rubble. And again, Hamas continues, wants to do this, despite all of it, upholding their commitment to this so-called peace plan so they can try to get some kind of aid, the stop of attacks, anything to help the Palestinian people. However, on the other side, just one of the examples that we've seen recently on from Zionists on TV, we had a man on Zionist on live television on a Hebrew media channel actually making inhumane comments of a mother, Palestinian mother, who had lost her child, the death of her child, and he made a comment saying she's probably the one that ate up all his food as he died of starvation. I mean, this again, these ridiculous comments are what has let this regime gain the so-called selective application of international law. Mr. Hamia, with your experience with being there in another axis of resistance in Lebanon, axis of resistance in general, what is it that makes Hamas and the resistance uphold their side of these ceasefires, uphold their commitment, knowing what the other side is going to do?
Well, we all know that Israel cannot be trusted. The United States is always creating some new annexes to delete all agreements agreed upon. And it's in front of us, 1701, UN resolution, 10,000 violation by Israel, none by Lebanon, and still the American putting pressure on Lebanon, not on Israel. And also the peace plan that we are talking about that been declared on Sharm el-Sheikh by Donald Trump, we all knew that only the first two or three items or articles out of the 20 points will be implemented, because we know that the Israelis will directly will go up and say we will not continue on such agreement. It's like a contradiction within Israel will be coming out, because we have to continue what we started. So even though there is agreements, they will not do it. They will not implement such agreements on Gaza, especially on Gaza and Lebanon. So what's like briefly, complicity against the Palestinian, supporting the Israeli entity just to continue what started. They told Israel just agree on the 20 points plan and then do whatever you want as soon as you receive all your hostages or your POWs from the Palestinian, then do whatever you want to do. And that's what they are doing. And exactly they are doing in Lebanon. We see that they call it the blue line in Lebanon, they call it yellow line in Gaza. They call it like exchange POWs in between Lebanon and Israel, and nothing is happening. And also with Gaza now, it's the Hamas is implementing all what been agreed upon, the Israeli not. I think that we are lost between the George W. Bush roadmap and the Trump peace plan. All what we hear is only saying and claiming of being with the peace plan, but no, I think now we are in a different stage. Israel at the beginning, they were calling with the Arabs land against peace, then peace against peace, now agreements against peace, and this agreement should be under and under the wing of the Abraham Accord.
Yes, well, Mr. Hami, as you're mentioning, so basically what we're seeing, anything that comes from the U.S. or the Zionist entity, it's the same agreement, just reworded. Technical terms have been perhaps changed, but it's the same thing that we've been seeing. And in response, the same reaction by the Zionist entity and its Western allies. Let's go ahead and get in a few more questions before we run out. Mr. Napier, let's go ahead and focus just a moment on the situation that occupied West Bank, because this is basically the world's attentions on Gaza, on Sudan, on other parts. The IDF, these settlers, are carrying out what can only be described as summary executions there in the West Bank. Is this a deliberate strategy to shatter any remaining Palestinian social structure, in your opinion?
Yes, it is part of a long-term plan which accelerated over the last 2 years to drive all Palestinians out of Palestine and to replace them with Zionist Jews from around the world, to hold on to the land that was stolen from the Palestinians, and which, by the way, this land in international law remains the property of the original Palestinian owners. But so to hold on to that, to hold on to that land, to drive out the owners, the native people, the Palestinians, it's very clear. Look, in science, if you have a simple theory which explains everything, this is like heaven. In this hellish situation in Palestine, a simple theory explains everything. Israel wants Palestine without Palestinians. In order to achieve that, they have to use massive violence, because you cannot charm the Palestinians into leaving. You cannot persuade them to leave. This is their land and they want to hold on to it. Therefore, great violence, ingenious violence, barbaric violence is absolutely a central part of the Zionist plan. And it has to be. It was against the black people in Australia. It was against the native people in North America. It was against the native people of Argentina. The colonists who moved in with their families began to exterminate them. That's what's happening. That everything else is just commentary. The only thing which can stop this is resistance across the entire region of West Asia and around the world by solidarity movements. We can contribute, to answer your first question, we can contribute through solidarity. That is by fighting on behalf of the Palestinian people against their common enemies by an amount that we can never know. We can reduce the enormous price of their freedom. Palestine will be free, but we can lower the cost of that.
Well, Mr. Napier, as you're saying, we can contribute to this. We do have around a little over a minute during this episode, and I would like if you could both kindly answer this question around 30 seconds. In a quick message to our audience, in the face of this ongoing genocide, what does a meaningful solidarity demand of us depend beyond protests? I mean, how can these people who are on the streets, as we saw today, in capitals around the world, force their governments to end their complicity and stop the slaughter now, not tomorrow, but today? Mr. Napier, I'm going to start off with you, please.
The same way that solidarity activity has managed to close down arms companies that were supplying Israel, has forced the Scottish government against its will to recognize the genocide and to support BDS. This is the way forward. And if we can learn from Italy in the last few weeks, that's the way forward to support the liberation of Palestine.
And Mr. Hamia, your answer to this question, please.
Yes, we should, as activists in the solidarity with the Palestinian people, to say that most of the governments around the world, and especially the United States and the Israeli government, to show that they are lying by declaring peace for the Palestinian cause and two states solution. And they are acting at the same time genocide against the Palestinians. So declaring peace and acting genocide against the Palestinian will not work. And we should work hard to continue in expose such lies to the media.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank both of you gentlemen for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. Mr. Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. They're joining us from Glasgow. And, of course, as always, Mr. Ali Hamid, political analyst and military expert, joining us from southern Lebanon. Pleasure to have you both with us. Until next time, goodbye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma once more. I have the honor to be your host in this program. And I have two very dear guests, Brother Liaqat and Sister Zainab. And I'm sure that your company is going to be so enjoyable and we're going to have a lot of insights to be sharing with each other. So just like always, we have this ritual of the guests presenting themselves for the audience who have just joined us. Please give us a very brief introduction about yourself. And let's start with Sister Zainab, ladies first.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm Turpalin Zainab Askari. I actually hail from India, but I have been living in Iran for some 10 years now. I studied science, then linguistics, and then Hausa, so I'm a multidisciplinary student.
Which makes you perfect for this program. And then you, Brother Liaqat?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm Muhammad Liaqat Abbas from India. I've done my bachelor's in Islamic history and currently I'm about to finish my master's in psychology.
Very good. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming here.
Thank you.
Well, nobody has promised us a perfect life, but all the difficulties aside, there is one difficulty that seems to be very staggering and very depressing, and that is for when you start to realize that your friend has talked so much badly behind your back. And then at that moment, you feel, wow, I never had that in mind. I never saw it coming.
Yeah. Someone who talks bad behind your back, how could they be your friends first in the first place? So,
well, how can I realize she would ever talk behind my back or not? Like, in my face, she's very kind to me. In my face, she is heaven. But behind my back, she might have some objections, some complaints, and some other stuff. And
yeah,
some comments,
but the brave
maybe
human
even.
Being is who comes and tells you in your face. Like Imam Ali Alayhissalam says that if you want to advise someone, advise them in person and not in a gathering. So meaning again, like do not, if you like advise someone in person, you constructed that person. Otherwise, if you did that in a gathering or somewhere else, you destructed that person. So this is a big destruction, basically, if someone is not coming to you, telling you directly. And sometimes, like, this hurts more when the things that are talked about are not true at all. That hurts more.
Yeah, because that third person, because you know how the stories would go and fly and spread.
Yeah.
It's not like they're going to be authentically conveyed to the other people. No, they would add their own perspective. They would add their own.
We used to say in our culture that when conversation is conveyed from one person to another person, they add mirch masala to it, which means which means they add spices to it, and
that's the whole idea.
Or they subtract something, or they.
But
mix
even
up
without that masala part,
yeah,
it still would be too hurting, too much. Has it ever happened to you, brother?
A lot of times.
And then what was your reaction?
A lot of times.
Bismillah happens with the good people.
Yeah. Inshallah. So a lot of times I've gone through this feeling of being close to a few people or a few friends probably. And later on I got backstabbed. That was the most devastating thing. That was the most, I would say, depressing thing.
Exactly,
but,
yeah.
But alhamdulillah, with the musibah of Ahlul Bayt alayhi muslim, I used to remember how they were backstabbed. And that is where, that I would say that was my turning point. Wherever I would get depressed, I would cry on the Ahlul Bayt upon how they were mistreated, how they were badly treated.
Yeah.
And that would bring down my sorrows and I would forget easily.
Yeah, because compared to their sorrows,
that,
we call sorrow is very trivial and very childish.
It's really nothing.
Very lifelike, earthly.
Give the same example in spouses. Okay. So the husband felt bad because of something, like the wife has said something and the husband feels bad. So there's a an immediate reaction. There's a nuke bomb over
there.
There's
no
right
way for the husband or wife to think that, okay, think about
think
the 95% that is good and it's only 5% that it's bad.
The 5% is focused so much that
so exaggerated.
It will be as if like there's no 95% existing
at
all.
It's only
5%.
I think only in their case it's like they would focus more on the good parts. Like, I think we need to think as spouses.
So we shouldn't tell them about the bad parts,
no,
which
like
are
that.
Hurting us.
No,
like
it's not like that. It's like, I think we should express our gratitude for that 95% good they have been. And they have, because of that 95% good thing, they have also helped you to be a good human being because you're together on a journey.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, on a suggestion part, you can tell, like, if we add this to our life, our life would be much better because, like, you know, Imam Ali alayhi salam also says that if your today is like your yesterday, then you're not progressing.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, like, your tomorrow should be much better than today. So, yeah, in those, in the, you know, in the envelope of these ahadiths, you tell something like, you know, we need to, I think we
I
need
get
to add,
what you're saying.
I think we need to add this to improve
that.
Our lives.
You try to say that. We shouldn't approach someone with a bad attitude and then try,
you don't approach with bad attitude, actually. You intend to correct that, maybe, many times. But what we forget is...
Yeah, but that tells a lot about
person.
How I think of them.
Exactly. And the anger, what will you do about the anger? Example, now that you have known about
the question, actually.
Quality, like what the person has done behind your back, and now you're confronting the person right in front of you, and you have... like, mashallah, anger on your face. How would you control that thing?
No, it's not like...
would you ever tell her that I heard you said something behind my back?
Yeah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Your friend has talked so much badly behind your back. And then at that moment, you feel, wow, I never had that in mind.
But I would probably go for the reasons.
There,
like,
there
what led
here.
This person? I would, in the first place,
she
I would not judge.
She would give you numerous justifications.
No, I would ask justifications from her. Like, I would ask justifications from myself. Like, I would ask, if I hear that, in the first place, I see all the sources. Okay, from wherever the sources I heard, were they authentic? Number two, I see like Imam Ali alayhi salam says, give 70 positive assumptions before judgment. So maybe I will say like, the, maybe the person was depressed.
In general masses, this is very difficult. They will not give possibilities.
But at the moment I felt like being with this person is going to be very, very toxic in my life, I walked away. Rather than like telling the person why
okay,
do you...
Okay, this is the end you're speaking about. But example, yeah. There are two cases. In case number one, you have heard about certain thing being spoken behind you,
mm-hmm.
and you have a lot of time to think,
and you
then
don't know
you are
the
confronting
the
person.
Narrator. You don't know the original narrator of the story. That's okay. It's okay.
But
when it's your
case.
Friend and not any friend, your close friend,
mm-hmm.
it's like the ceiling is going to collapse in your head, and then you feel like your heart has been crushed.
I actually have been in those places, literally. Like I, in the end of the day, I actually, rather than, you know, bombarding on them, I bombarded on myself. Like, why to trust so much, and why to let anything go out? Like, you know, if you keep candies open, you will see if you keep a candy in its packet, and if you keep a candy open, all the flies will come to the open candy. So why do I keep my secrets that way open that, you know, any fly would come and use that?
Yeah.
So it's very important sometimes, not every secret is meant to be told, which could be, you know, misused later on. So I have always bombarded myself rather than bombarding on the person, like, why did you do so? And also my expectations. I lower my expectations from people, like, because expectations are something that hurt you.
By the way, I have to mention something. As for me, and I have seen many people like me, like, when they hear something bad about themselves coming from their close friends, I do not confront people. I change my perspective. And that's bad.
We have this in Kashmir.
That's too bad.
They say, that means recognize the person, but don't say anything to him.
Yeah, I don't say anything to her, but now my perspective has changed, not just towards her, but towards everyone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this
towards
helps
everyone.
You to keep,
towards
this helps,
everyone.
This helps you to choose wise friends.
So it's
why
creates,
is it everyone?
It creates actually a sort of trust issue problem. Like this person
it has
that
a ripple
I
effect.
Thought for a long time is so close to me, is so trustworthy, thinks of me in this certain way. Like she has got these assumptions that are no way me.
I think trust issues are okay in the long run if it's at the cost of your reputation. Like if your reputation is not at the, you know...
At a stake.
Yeah. That way, even if you have trust issues, I think it's okay. It's completely okay not to trust every third person.
So it's because of this reason, because you have lost your trust on everyone, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will see the intensity of you losing trust on everyone. Example, a person giving sadaqah, he gave a sadaqah to someone, and it turns out that the person who has received sadaqah was not an eligible person.
Mm-hmm.
So this person will never ever give. He makes a decision that he will make a point that I'm not going to give sadaqah anymore. It's because of that person who has taken sadaqah. So now he has lost trust in, like, example, the poor people. Oh, they are not poor. They just ask for help, just like that. Okay, so why should I give my money? Okay, there are two things. Number one is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will punish the person who has taken sadaqah because he is the reason for this person to lose trust upon the poor people.
And making
number
generalization.
Number two, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will ask this person as well, why have you lost trust in other poor people? You see, isn't it logical to lose trust? Or you shouldn't be losing trust, actually.
Yeah.
So you have to see the situation. So when it comes to like, knowing and confronting people in front of you, there are a lot of issues like anger issues, and people has to go through anger management over here. And I've seen a lot of cases.
Maybe people don't have that, you know, face to face you.
Mm-hmm.
They can't face you when they know that they did wrong behind your back. How can they face you?
Okay, this is at that place where they are friends. But what about in families? Example, a brother, a sister, a cousin of ours, spouses, children. Over here, things
like
change completely.
Like the moment you want to confront them, they don't have that, you know, they don't have that capability to face you. Because they know, like, even in families, they know.
So you mean they're ashamed?
Yeah, they are, like, everyone knows about their deeds. Everyone knows that if I talked behind her back, it was correct or it was incorrect. It was valid or invalid. And if they know it was invalid, they can't face you. They have that.
No, they can't. No, not they always. Can say they are sorry. They can't
not always.
Say that they're sorry.
But what will
but
you do about the
really
person?
Like in, I have been in Brother Liaquat's place where he said, like, you know, you feel you lose trust on people, like where you feel they were not eligible. Like, unfortunately, I was very generous to one of the persons in the family itself. Like, but then it's not like they were eligible or not eligible. It's like they were so ungrateful in the end, like completely did upside down. And it stopped me for a while to be generous towards
other people. Yeah, this
is
actually the psychological effect. Because it creates trauma, and
exactly.
And
yeah.
A person
and
might go,
scared
might really
things.
Go till heights. Example, the person might, example, commit
different
suicide.
Different complexes
might,
are going
might,
to be, yeah.
Might kill the opposite person. These are there. These are real issues in the world. And
so do not take your words very slightly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Words are very important, and
words
they are the strongest
important.
Weapons human being has actually ever created. You have to take this into consideration that your words have got a lot of impact on people.
That's why Imam Ali Alayhi Salaam says, think before you speak.
Yeah. Your mouth is the guardian.
Yeah.
Do not
if
let it out.
If this happens in every one of us, I would say most of our issues will be solved in marriage issues. Example, issues between the spouses, issues between brothers and sisters.
Yeah,
everything
would be solved
everything,
if
everything.
We just be cautious of the
cautious
words
and
that we
not getting
use.
Angry while getting when
and
we,
not
we are angry, yeah.
Just ratifying final decisions about people.
And not everything is meant to be shared. You know, as you said, that our mouth is a guardian.
Yeah.
It reminds me of one of the analogy that our teacher used to give. Akhlaq teacher, the moral, you know, she would teach us moral ethics, and she would say that, look at your teeth themselves. We usually say that, oh, my tongue slipped because it does not have a bone, it just slips. But look at your 32 teeth, they are the 32 guardians. So why you look at this way, why don't you look at the other way?
Yeah.
So there's a beautiful analogy, like you have 32 watch keepers before you start.
Yeah.
Saying something.
So the betrayals that come from your close ones are the strongest, the saddest, and the most depressing ones. But sometimes we need to go through that in order to actually learn some things about ourselves and about the other people. I guess we shared enough of insight in today's episode. I hope that comes fruitful to all of you. And thank you for staying with us until another episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك Tossy daylight again, once again. You're not aware that we're aware of your despair. Don't show your tears to your oppressor. Don't show your tears. Try not to cry. David slew Goliath. This
this very same place that we be at. Passing through the same time, this land been a victim of countless crimes. From crusaders, mongers, to the present aggression. Then the Franks, now even a cruel oppression. If these walls could speak, imagine, what would they say? For me in this path that I walk on, there's only one way. Bullets may kill, bones may break. Still I throw stones like David before me, and I say.
Try not to cry.
No pierdas la fe, la sed, la calma el que hace. Agua de la arena, y tú que te levantas con orgullo entre las piedras. Has hecho mares de este polvo.
Yeah, I throw stones at my eyes, for too long they've been dry. Plus they see what they shouldn't from oppressed babies to thighs. I throw stones at my tongue, cause shit should really keep its peace. I throw stones at my feet, cause they stray and lead to defeat. Couple of big ones at my heart, cause the thing is freezing cold. But my nub's still alive and kicking, unstoppable on a roll. I throw bricks at the devil, so I'll be sure to hit him. But first at the man in the mirror, so I can chase out the venom.
Little boy, shining ahead. Just another kid sent out to get some bread. Not the first murder, nor the last. Again and again, a repetition of the past.
Since the very first day, same story.
Young ones, old ones, some glory. How can it be? Has the whole world turned blind? Or is it just cause it's only affecting my kind? If these walls could speak, imagine what would they say? For me, this path that I walk on, there's only one way.
Bones may kill, bones may break. Stand up those stones. David, I say,
bullets may kill, bones may break, still I throw stones. David, I say,
try not to cry.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
On November 20th, inside a packed IAEA Board of Governors meeting room in Vienna, a familiar drama played out once again. With 19 votes in favor, the European Troika, joined by Washington, pushed through yet another resolution demanding that Iran fully and immediately expand cooperation with nuclear inspectors. The text calls on Tehran to hand over precise data about its 60% enriched uranium stockpiles and to open the gates of its nuclear facilities to agency personnel, among many other demands. But Tehran saw this coming. Iranian diplomats had warned that any new hostile measures would reflect Western political ambitions, not nuclear facts. And they point to what they call the real trigger for today's crisis. The June attacks on Iran's safeguarded nuclear facilities carried out by the United States and the Israeli regime. Once again, Iran's peaceful nuclear program has become a convenient stage for political theater, pressure that has never succeeded in stopping Iran from pursuing its legitimate nuclear rights. It's a game that seems to never end. That's how Iran frames the IAEA's approach, a process designed to keep Tehran in a permanent limbo until it yields to Western demands. Russia, China, and Niger voted against the resolution. 12 other countries abstained. The split vote underscored a truth everyone in the room already knew. The board is deeply polarized and nowhere close to consensus. In a joint statement, 8 countries, that is Belarus, China, Cuba, Iran, Nicaragua, Russia, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, condemned the U.S. and Israeli attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities and denounced the push for a new resolution. They urge member states to resist politicizing Iran's nuclear file and reject the draft entirely. While the resolution ultimately passed, the combined 12 abstentions and 3 no votes revealed what Iran called a gap between reality and truth inside the agency. Dr. Afifeh Abedi, a prominent journalist and foreign policy researcher, provided us with her analysis of the vote's composition.
در ادامه این روند به نظر میرسه که قطعنامه هم که از طرف شورای حکام
It appears that the resolution adopted by the Board of Governors with a very narrow and fragile margin, as you know, it received 19 votes in favor and the combined number of votes against and abstentions was almost the same, can once again be described as a political move designed to serve the maximum pressure campaign pursued by the West and the Zionist regime against Iran.
Tehran went further, describing the resolution as an unconstructive attempt by the European Troika and the U.S. to compensate for their failed snapback attempt at the U.N. Senior political analyst Dr. Hossein Kanani Moghaddam offered further insight into the resolution.
The core content of this resolution is to impose a 3-month deadline, after which the case would be referred to the UN Security Council, enabling the Council to pass a resolution against Iran and take action. If we think of this resolution as a nuclear reactor, the core of that reactor, in terms of impact, is that it confirms the snapback mechanism, reinstates the 6 previous resolutions, and once again alleges Iran's lack of cooperation. It does not call for the suspension of Iran's nuclear activities, but for their complete shutdown. It also reinforces the requirement for Iran to return to the safeguards agreement it accepted and signed in 2003, an agreement that is binding and legally enforceable because it clearly outlines Iran's obligations. This resolution effectively revives Iran's file, which was close to being removed from the Board of Governors' agenda. It states that in every upcoming board session, Iran's nuclear case must remain one of the items on the agenda.
The irony, Iran notes, is that the IAEA itself has acknowledged the very real consequences of the June attacks. Normal safeguards were disrupted, inspectors were withdrawn, and Iran, saying it acted in good faith, still allowed verification activities to resume at facilities unaffected by the attacks. Grossi's own report recognized Iran's domestic legal requirements and affirmed the agency's commitment to respecting Iranian security concerns. Yet the sponsors of the resolution barely mentioned any of this. During special board sessions, they avoided reference to the attacks entirely,
even though the IAEA's official report documents them.
The EU, speaking for its 27 members, stressed that diplomacy is the only viable path forward. With six UN resolutions reinstated, the EU said all members are now obligated to require Iran to suspend all enrichment, reprocessing, and heavy water activities. The Union insisted Iran had sidestepped its JCPOA commitments for 6 years and that its enriched uranium stockpile has ballooned to nearly 50 times the JCPOA limit. Mr. Hassan Beheshtipour, a senior political analyst, placed the recent resolution against Iran in context.
These resolutions are essentially a continuation of the nuclear case-building process against Iran. Since August 2002, Iran's peaceful nuclear activities were turned into an international issue, and from that point onward, it has been called Iran's nuclear file, while in reality it's a manufactured file. This case was created for Iran, and one of the main platforms where this case building happens is the IAEA and its Board of Governors. The importance of this resolution is not simply that another resolution has been issued and Iran will not implement it, so it does not matter. It does matter because they are creating documentation against us. When a country is discussed and voted on in a 35-member body, and an 8-paragraph text is issued as a ruling, that text becomes another sheet added to the previous ones. Iran's file at the Board of Governors includes over 120 Director General reports issued every 3 months and more than 40 resolutions. The resolution adopted in this recent round is effectively the 10th in the latest phase. From an international standpoint, the problem is that each new resolution becomes another documented claim layered onto the previous ones, strengthening their narrative. The other key issue is that this gives Germany, the UK, France, and behind the scenes the US and Israel a pretext. They can now cite these resolutions as justification for taking new actions or imposing additional measures against Iran.
According to EU claims, Iran holds more than 440 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium and over 10 significant quantities of highly enriched material. Some of this, they allege, has been unaccounted for over 5 months. With those accusations on the table, the Troika defended their decision to activate snapback, reviving six old UN Security Council resolutions and using them as a legal basis for the new joint resolution with Washington. What is the significance of the recent anti-Iranian resolution adopted by the IAEA, and what would be the possible repercussions?
One of the outcomes of this resolution is exactly the document-building process I mentioned earlier. They are trying to create legitimacy for actions that are in fact illegitimate. When a nuclear site is operating under IAEA,